Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Good morning to lurking conservatives. How is everybody? It's Monday. I realize that, so let's do the best we can. Good morning, Mark Riley.
Good morning, Mark Maron.
Oh, my God. Okay, so there you go. Kalo, how you doing? You all right?
I'm great, buddy. Everybody's how you doing? Good.
I don't know yet. You know, I'm trying to figure it out. Did you have a good weekend, everybody? You?
I had a good weekend. Yeah. I saw something I really hadn't thought of before.
Thank God.
What? Contemplate.
What?
Real estate. That's why I'm waiting for Wayne Gilman to get here.
Oh really? Yeah. You out looking at houses?
Wasn't really out looking at houses, but my wife and daughter were, and I just started thinking. I saw this show on TV where this guy, you know, a relatively young guy, became a developer, and like, you know, seems to be doing like real well for himself.
Hence, that's why he would be on television.
Yeah, absolutely.
they don't have developers that are like, I don't know what the hell went wrong. I lost everything. I can't speculate for crap, and I don't know what the hell I'm going to do, but here, buy my book. Here's a series of tapes that'll show you how to fail in real estate.
But see, this guy wasn't one of those. Yeah. He was just like a guy who he was a contractor who decided to become a developer, and he had like 40, 50 properties in this city over in England. I forgot which one it was, but the thing is, he could walk into a place and tell immediately how much it would take to fix it and how long it would take to fix it.
Wow, it sounds like someone ordered the tapes.
Yeah, well, this guy certainly did. No, he said it was due to 15 years worth of experience as a contractor.
But is he selling something, this guy? You just saw him being interviewed? What was it?
No. He went and he bid on this place that he was going to fix up and resell. So they followed him through the bidding process. He hadn't seen the place before he decided, you know, to do it, and they went in with him. He stood in the middle of the place, said, okay, this is how much it's going to cost, and I will get 14 to 20% back on my investment. I can't do that in the stock market. That's why I'm in real estate.
You got to be willing to spend it, though. You got to let go of that money. I don't know. And how's
you
got
to be willing to risk it.
Yeah. How's your luck, Riley?
I haven't started yet.
Okay.
Are you kidding me?
I'm just saying in general, if you look back over your life,
I've never, ever thought about doing something that speculative before.
See, I think some people, it really depends. If you're willing to just, you know, say this money is going to go into that, I'm not going to worry about whether I lose it or not, or take the chance and not beat the hell out of yourself for the rest of your life, then I think you got to have that disposition.
You got to be a risk taker, absolutely.
Yeah, I don't have that disposition entirely, you know, and which I think limits me. I think that in order to really to get some savings together and to get, you know, to get a nest egg or retirement or whatever, you got to be willing to risk. Of course, you got to have the dough up front to do it, but you got to be willing to risk money.
You do have to be willing to risk. But see, there are also people who are entrepreneurs. They're folks that are, you know, the risk is what they get off on to some extent. And in some cultures, Mark, it is more important that even if you fail, that you get back up and try again. That if you don't, that is considered dishonorable rather than failing and then trying another business or trying a different way, again, to put out that risk.
Failing, just accepting your failure and realizing this maybe isn't my bag and I'm just going to have to live like a schlub for the rest of my life.
That is frowned upon in some cultures.
All I know is my wife is sitting around looking at real estate listings in New York, and I'm like, oh, no, we're doing this. Is this going to happen again? And I don't have a fortune.
What happened the first time?
I got a house, and she keeps telling me that we did the right thing, and it's the greatest investment we could have, and I believe her to some extent, but I don't think we bought at the top of the market. But this is all new to me, Riley. I'm the kind of guy, because I have a life in stand-up, where you make some dough or you get a TV deal or whatever. It may not go anywhere. If you got some money in the bank, I'm like, that money staying in the bank because I don't know what the hell is going to happen. And I'm still sort of like that. But maybe if I start gambling a little bit, maybe if I start throwing it down on real estate, I've been offered some opportunities to put some money into stuff that they say it'll double in a year, that kind of stuff.
I'm a little wary of people saying something's going to double in a year because that sounds to me like, you know.
It's kind of shady, right?
Marijuana sales. But I don't know.
And then I get concerned because genetically I'm not predisposed to success in investments. My father was not the smartest investor, and it happens to people.
And you can get soaked in real estate, too. That's why I want to talk to our good friend, who is, you know, had a modicum of success.
I think you really got, you know, I think there's a mixture of instincts and information you have to have.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I'm the kind of person, I'll read up on something, and I don't want to do all the research, and I want someone to do it for me. But as soon as you start trusting people, then all of a sudden, it's a different game. If you're not trusting yourself, and you've aligned yourself with some guy, like, hey, he seems to know what he's doing. It sounds like a great idea. Those are famous last words before someone loses hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Well, see, that's what impressed me about this guy. Mm-hmm. He had a crew of people. He said, look, this place is going to take me between, at maximum, 6 weeks to renovate. And he said, I'm going to take X amount of dollars. This is how much it's going to cost, and this is how much I'm going to sell it for. And they brought in two independent appraisers, both of whom nailed exactly the price he did.
Yeah.
So, and he sold them.
I tell you, you got to have money to do this. And like, from what we're hearing about Social Security, we're going to talk to Paul Krugman later in the show.
Yeah.
And this, this you know, it is not what it seems to be. You know, the new pitch is it's going to help the poor, but, you know, the middle class and the upper echelon of the culture are going to, to people it doesn't matter, they're really rich, it's not going to make an impact at all. It's going to hurt the middle class, and it's probably ultimately going to hurt the lower class as well. And it's interesting that, you know, we talk about this, right? We talk about investing and everything else. And a lot of people, you know, aren't in a position to do that. I'm barely in a position to do that.
But me too.
Yeah, exactly. But we, you know, the middle class is, you know, we think that this is the right way to do things. And I think more so than not, we get screwed out of a lot of money.
Well, look, when we get into the Social Security thing,
yeah.
You will find out that, again, this is one of those situations where a particular conservative group of people have an agenda, and it is a large, overarching agenda, and what we see the president doing now is an incremental step in trying to get to the end game here.
Which is to make Social Security a
thing of the past.
Yeah, a welfare program, essentially.
Yes.
And then slowly, as we know, Republicans like to gut welfare, cut it until it goes away. So this is part of the gutting of Social Security.
People could wake up one day at the age of 65 and find out that they only got 5 years of Social Security benefits before it's all gone, before they cut it off.
And it's really a misunderstanding. Like, I know my mother, who, you know, was a middle-class person all her life, and you would think that the idea is that middle-class people, and certainly people of upper class, of a lot of money, you know, don't really count on Social Security. But you don't know what the hell's going to happen. You don't know where you're going to be sitting when you're 65, you know, what your life is going to look like. You're always going to be counting on that money,
yeah.
I believe.
But see, the right wants you to count on it less. That is the end game of this entire Social Security scheme that they're putting forward, is to make people with modest incomes, the middle income heart of America that they say they're trying to super serve, by the way, to make them less and less dependent on Social Security, so that two generations from now, it will be the investments that people make that will be the bottom line,
exactly,
as to how they retire.
They're trying to get more people to have the conversation you and I just had 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
That's our future. That's what we're banking on. We're not even thinking about Social Security. I got to admit, I don't think about it much, and I haven't thought about it in the past, not because I'm an investor. I'm just, you know, I'm stupid and have no vision. You know, I just assume.
You and me both.
I just assume, like, hey, you know, today's good. Who knows what the hell's going to happen in the future? I'm a moron like that.
Well, look, you know, we are seeing America, and you say this all the time, we are getting more and more ever closer to an adapt or die society. They are going to force these changes on people if people are not careful and if people are not prepared to defend what we already have. As far as these, not just Social Security, Medicare too.
Right.
Hundreds of thousands of people are going to get knocked off the rolls in the next 5 or 6 years, and the federal government's going to be able to say, well, it's the states, it's
mm-hmm.
not me. All we did was reform the system.
No one ever takes blame.
No, least of all some of the other people we're going to be talking about later this morning.
I know. It's unbelievable, though. What you're saying is that it goes back and forth. They'll blame the states will blame the federal government, and then it just sort of dissipates, and still there's hundreds of thousands of people that can't get health coverage.
Exactly. Oh. Exactly. And that is the end game, folks. You may think they're trying to cloak this in some kind of, you know, Health Care Protection Act language. That's not what they have planned for us.
Well,
trust me.
We're going to get into it with Paul Krugman, who is definitely the guy who's been on the beat of this thing for, you know, since the beginning. He's a great New York Times columnist. That's later in the show. When we come back, though, very interesting stuff about the idea that terror threats are now down, that there's a report out that says domestic terror threats are now down. And what does that mean exactly? You know, what does it mean that the number of terror threats are down? Is it real terror threats? Is it fake terror threats? Is it just that the Republicans have gotten everything they wanted so they no longer need the terror threat as a tool? We'll talk about it when we come back at 16 past the hour.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Anti-drug. To learn more, call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com.
Paid for by Office of National Drug Control Policy.
Next year, HarperCollins will proudly publish The Diary of Ronald Reagan. Morning Sedition has obtained these exclusive entries from the pen of the nation's 40th president.
Inauguration Day, January 20th, 1981. I was introduced to the nuclear football this evening. It wasn't a football at all, but a briefcase with coals and a satellite phone inside. Nobody thought it was funny when I threw it Hail Mary at Bushy. Jets were scrambled. I was thrown to the ground. Nancy took advantage of the confusion and went and smashed all the White House china that Rosalind had bought. Ooh, a bowling alley. I make a note to inquire about 10-pound balls. I'm a funny president. Uh-oh, sleep.
This has been another excerpt from The Diary of Ronald Reagan, brought to you by Morning Sedition.
21 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Yes, it is.
Did I space out there for a second?
It's okay.
There's nothing worse than looking up, seeing the board up, going, you, now.
Speak.
Go. Well, this is deceiving and weird, this article. Reports of credible terrorist threats against the United States are at the lowest level since attacks of September 11, 2001, according to U.S. intelligence officials and federal and state law enforcement authorities. I think the key word here is credible terrorist threats, Riley. Don't you? I mean, they're now saying that the number of credible threats, that means that either they figured out a way to sort out the ones that are bogus and not respond to them, or the whole thing has been a sham. It seems to me that before the election, they were more than willing to act on any terrorist threat, to raise the level at any time, every other day when it served their particular political agenda. Now it seems that they're just turning it the other way because it serves their agenda now.
I don't understand how the number of credible terrorist threats and this decline that they're talking about stacks up against what our man Larry Johnson told us just the other week about the actual number of worldwide terrorist attacks. And by the way, there was an effort on the part of the U.S. government to separate domestic terror attacks from international terrorist attacks. However, Larry Johnson's numbers, the ones he gave us last week, turned out to be absolutely accurate. The number of significant international terrorist attacks rose to 650 from 175 in 2003. Now, that's an estimate. It's around 650, and it was around 175. So how do you take these two stories and reconcile them? On the one hand, one agency says, well, the number of threats is down to an all-time low. And on the other, the number of actual attacks worldwide has tripled.
And Larry Johnson should know. I mean, he's a former counterterrorism intelligence guy. He's like an intelligence official who we've had on the show a few times. He should certainly know. It doesn't make any sense. Riley, the thing that scares me the most is that you get people that are in the FBI, that are in law enforcement, and this is what scares me. Counterterrorism officials said the atmosphere, particularly in Washington, in the Washington, D.C. area, has calmed because they are less jittery and less inclined to warn the public about every vague, unsubstantiated threat. In the past, they feared being accused of missing something. It just seems to me that because the political climate has shifted and these guys want to take the fear out of the public now, before they wanted to put it in to guarantee that they maintain power. And now that they have, consolidated power, they want people to relax. But it seems that some people within the FBI said, Michael A. Mason, the assistant director in charge of the FBI's Washington field office, said that as far as he's concerned, there is no drop in the threat level. Quote, the desire to harm Americans is certainly still out there, whether that is wrapped around a specific threat or not. End quote. And I think that what you're saying, Riley, that these global terrorist numbers attest to that. And the idea that everybody should relax, I think a lot of law enforcement officials are like, I don't know if that's really what you want to be putting out there. Just because they've decided to stop acting on not uncredible threats does not mean that the threat doesn't exist or that it's still it's not here. It's just that they were politicizing it before and they're politicizing it again. Now, what do you think, Riley? Is there something to do with money why they would want to pull back from getting? I imagine you can't send the police forces into overtime and into panic mode every 5 minutes because that costs a lot of money, doesn't it?
Well, it does cost a lot of money. And the other side of this, Mark, and the part I think that people ought to be a little bit nervous about here is that the 9/11 attacks were preceded by a series of events where terrorists attack targets outside the United States. There is, at times, a correlation between attacks outside the United States and plots for attacks inside the United States. Now, if the number of attacks is at an all-time high outside the country, if it more than tripled from last year, I think people ought to be, it's true. There is probably increased security. It might be a little tougher. But, terrorists think in increments just like the religious right does. They are waiting. They may hit someplace over here, in Asia or maybe in Africa. And then when they feel people's guards are down, when they feel that people have relaxed from the threat of terrorism, when they think that inspector's not going to question them about what they have in their bags, that's when they'll act.
And it's scary, too, because as Larry Johnson, a former counterterrorism official, said that, abroad, this puts Americans more in danger. And abroad, it puts people, governments or armed forces that are aligned with Americans in more danger as well. That clearly the attacks are still going on against Americans and people aligned with Americans. We're just not seeing it now because they're regrouping on some level, and they've chosen not to report false threats, which is why didn't they do that before? Because it didn't serve their agenda.
Absolutely not.
And also talking about information previous to 9/11, a federal judge overseeing the prosecution of Zacharias Moussaoui has blocked an attempt by the Justice Department's Inspector General to release a report on FBI missteps prior to the September 11, 2001 attack. So there's still an attempt going on by people within the government to stifle information in terms of how we screwed up the first time.
Well, yeah, and see, the Moussaoui case has always been central. Remember that when Moussaoui first came, was first detained, he wanted to call all kinds of witnesses right up to Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, and he also wanted to call some al-Qaeda witnesses to testify at his trial. Now, obviously, that's not happening, and the American government is probably pretty happy that it's not. But the bottom line is the Moussaoui case could have been a very large mess for American intelligence. It's turned out not to be, but we're going to see what happens and whether or not this particular judge's ruling is going to stand.
And Korea.
North Korea. We got more to talk about that, too.
Talk about threats or not threats. We should definitely go into that when we come back here in a second. Right, Riley?
We're going to do that, and we're going to talk about a certain lobbyist who talked to a couple of media outlets when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Hi, this is former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, and when I want to keep pace with the job market, I tune into Morning Sedition's Monday Job Listing every week on Air America Radio.
Big media consolidation. We are polishing old Sparky. Do you see what I'm saying?
The Majority Report on Air America Radio.
Yeah, maybe I'll do it with one of those, the three-blade razors. I'm sorry, I just want to come in with... I can't tell you what we were talking about, but it's 34 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Wright.
Yo!
I swear to God, if we had the show that went on during the break...
Uh-huh.
Oh, my God. Clutch Larson's on vacation, and it's just insanity.
Oh,
beautiful.
News! Yeah.
But it's important stuff. I think that's going to be the pitch. I'd like to pitch a television show. This is any executive listening. They're not going to be listening in L.A. because we're not on there anymore. But we are. I'd like to present a show where you have a liberal radio show that, and we talk about all the news and events, and we have our point of view and our feelings.
But and then we edit that out, right?
Right, yeah. That gets edited out. It's just the breaks.
Yeah,
it's just
right?
Five guys in a room on the breaks of the liberal talk show.
Hey, wait a minute. You do that?
There's a lot of that. It would have to be on HBO.
Yeah.
Maybe we should pitch the same people that did Left of the Dial,
Bring them back.
It's just called the Dirty Dial behind the scenes or something like that. I don't know. So, look, you know, we know a lot of people out there are out of work. You know, Spencer Sunday from 3v1 at monster.com. Well, we want to help out. We want to be part of the solution, not the problem. So here's our Mornings Edition Monday Help Wanted listing. Wanted, incompetent go-getters for ethics investigation. After a brief hiatus, the House Ethics Committee is ready to get back to work, and we'd like you to be part of it. We are the Republican members of the Ethics Committee, and a few months ago we released our investigative staffs on the mistaken assumption that it was all biscuits and gravy from now on. So, now we're seeking motivated self-starters whose eagerness completely outstrips their abilities. Have you ever dreamed of being part of the exciting world of ethics investigation, but were told you were totally unqualified for the job, that you may just be the right person for this job? Ideal candidates for this position will be able to wade through thickets of complex travel documents and be totally dumbfounded. You must have the ability to collect and analyze evidence, some of it blatantly obvious, and remain blithely, unaware of its implications. If none of this makes sense to you, then by all means, contact us immediately. Minorities are encouraged to apply, especially the mentally handicapped.
Ooh.
There's a big reach out. Hey, come on. Everyone needs a job. There you go. All right, speaking about lobbying, now it seems to me that there's a huge piece in the New York Times Magazine on Sunday about Jack Abramoff. And if you look at the picture in the New York Times Magazine, he's like, ooh, feel sorry for me.
He looks like Al Bundy.
Yeah, well, he looks sad. He looks troubled. And this is a guy that's business has been destroyed. Everything is going downhill for him. And I believe rightfully so.
Oh, and absolutely rightfully so. But, you know, there was a piece in the New York Times Magazine over the weekend, and then another piece, an interview in Time Magazine. Mm-hmm. And in both of these pieces, Mark, you kind of process the information together, and you get a picture of a guy who is so resolute in his denial that the system that he operates in is a problem for most Americans. The idea that this is the way, you know, politics is about money, and you win in politics with money.
And for those of you who don't know who Jack Abramoff is, he was the lobbyist who's been, I guess, implicated in this delay ethics investigation, which is not really an investigation yet.
Not yet, but it was his credit card that delays expenses when he was over in England and over in Scotland. It was Abramoff and Ed Buckham's credit cards that those expenses were billed.
Yeah, and he was in partnership with Michael Scanlon, who was a spokesperson for Tom DeLay.
Yes.
These guys, you know, together, you know, built the Indians out of like multi-millions of dollars for political favors. This guy's business was essentially, you know, buying political favors, having congressmen in his pocket, primarily Tom DeLay. He was a guy that was, you know, offered the ability for anybody who wanted access to get access if they had the right amount of money. He was the guy that sort of helped push through legislation that allowed sweatshops to operate
in the North Mariana Islands.
And
absolutely.
He was the one that sort of like played two tribes against each other, then had legislation fixed through redistricting that, you know, put one of them out of business, and he like double dipped. He's willing to claim that this is the way lobbyists work. This is the way it happens. This is what goes down.
This is a very dangerous game Jack Abramoff is playing here, because to the extent that people feel that their elected representatives are part of this cesspool that produced him, mm-hmm. they're going to have problems. And he knows this already. This is part of the way Washington, D.C. operates. He's right about that. Democrats operate that way. Republicans operate that way. I've always had a problem with the notion that members of Congress, like, take these trips and, you know, make up the reasons for going on them later.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to Scotland because I want to talk to Scottish parliamentarians about how they implement the law. Give me a freaking break, would you please?
But the thing that pisses me off about Abramoff is that he's more than willing to sort of say, hey, I can't speak for Congress, but you might want to ask them.
Yeah.
I was just doing the job that, you know, I set out to do. So that's one of those situations where there's blame is starting to dissipate. Like, both sides are saying that it's the other guy's fault, and eventually, you know, whose fault is it really? Is it just Washington's? I think DeLay should go down, and I'm happy Jack Abramoff is out of business.
Well, he's not out of business yet now. You know, he's still got his restaurant signatures. It's still apparently a place where people hang out.
What do you give it?
Maybe we ought to talk to Johnny. Johnny K. Street mentioned this last week. Because I'm telling you, when this is all said and done, even if he is found to have broken no law, he's done as a lobbyist. I can't imagine he can rebound from this. But I've been wrong about that sort of thing before. People's politics, he may go the way of Gary Condit at this point. But Abramoff's problem is that he really sees nothing wrong with this world and really, you know, says, look, the only reason why they're coming after me is because I am successful. He can't really explain away some of these emails where he seems to be a money-grubbing, greedy racist in terms of the way he describes his own clients, not other. He's trying to say, well, it was the opponents I was describing. Nonsense. He was describing an entire group of people that had gone to him for help because they were told that this is the way they would have access. And the people that sit outside of this, the people that are waking up this morning trying to figure out how they're going to pay $2.50 for gas, the people that are worried about how in the world they're going to have their health maintained with no Medicaid, these people don't have this kind of access. They can't take these kinds of trips.
And the horrendous thing about Avramoff is he still says with a straight face, I'm assuming, that legislators only do their jobs at the behest of those people that they represent.
Yeah.
And at the behest and because of their own personal values. And there is no indication that that is true. These people could care less about the constituency. All they want to do is fool them into thinking that they're the right guy. And it turns out that a lot of people don't hold these people to ethical standards.
No, they don't hold them to ethical standards. And, you know, if you look at Avramoff's explanation as to how he came up with this kind of very coarse language in dealing both with his clients and the acquisition of money against his stated religious beliefs, there's no way to reconcile the two. Absolutely no way. He said, well, every now and then I have to lapse into the language of the people I'm dealing with. There's no evidence whatsoever that the people he was dealing with, at least in terms of his clients, use that kind of language.
I just hope the investigation goes further. And we were talking before about how you said this is a fairly new thing in lobbying, this kind of big money, kind of, you know, moving stuff around, that it wasn't always like that.
Well, in terms of the way the different parties have dealt with lobbying, the Democrats would not have gone out and tried to coerce people into hiring former aides to different people. See, this is how Avramoff spread a network out. He took former aides of Tom DeLay, who was a friend of his.
Michael Scanlon.
Yeah, and you know, placed them in jobs in different lobbying firms so that you had a Republican base of people in many of these different firms, people that were loyalists to the agenda of the Bush administration and, by inference, the agenda of Jack Avramoff's clients.
And you also got to realize that Jack Avramoff has been within the party for a long time. You know, he's been a conservative, it says in the New York Times article, since he was a kid. And
yep.
He was College Republican National Committee. He was the head of the College Republican National Committee, which was a job once held by Karl Rove.
Absolutely.
So this guy's been on the radar for a long time. And I have to assume he has been sort of built and mentored by the Republican Party to do what he does.
And he's going to be dropped like a bad habit by that same party that built him up.
Well, I hope it goes all the way to Tom DeLay.
Well, if you see, that's going to be the very interesting question. If Jack Avramoff sees his own empire crumbling and no way to, and if he sees many of his former friends abandoning him en masse, for example, like Bob Ney from Ohio,
mm-hmm.
who basically called him, who was he? Called Avramoff, I think, and Scanlon too. Almost nefarious individuals. If that kind of thing keeps up, he'll sing like Pavarotti.
You think so?
Absolutely.
So let's shift gears and talk about Korea for a couple minutes, because speaking of name calling, Kim Jong Il has called our president half baked.
Yes.
Morally half baked. I have to assume that something was lost in the translation with that. Half baked. Do they really call that? I remember the first time I heard that phrase, but it's not really important.
Yeah.
But he's called him the world's tyrant.
Yeah.
And apparently North Korea might have, I can't believe it's hard to tell whether or not a country shot a missile, given the satellite technology we have. It's still not clear whether they shot a missile over the weekend in the Sea of Japan.
It looks like they have confirmed that there was a missile shot over the Sea of Japan. And what's happening here, and people need to be clear, this is the same with North Korea and with Iran. This is, in North Korea's case, a cry for attention. They want to have not necessarily Bush, but certainly the West, sit down with them as equals and discuss a real plan for nuclear disarmament. What Americans don't understand about this is that not just North Korea, but Iran as well, want the United States to hold true to their plans to disarm. These countries that are developing emerging nuclear technology don't want to be told by somebody who already has it and has no plans to get rid of it that they have to get rid of theirs. They see an imbalance there.
And isn't it true that now the only way we can really know whether North Korea has the juice, has the technology, has the ability to do this, is whether or not they test in the next few months?
Yeah.
That's the only way we can find out if it's a credible story that they have the technology?
Well, yeah, if you have their leader calling Bush a Philistine whom we can never deal with, I think so, yeah.
And what is the theory? Like, you know, Iran and North Korea need the weapons in order to be global, to be able to negotiate on the world stage for things that they want. That's what they see as their tool.
That is their leverage. The Iranians, on the other hand, don't. They have resolutely denied that they're actually developing nuclear technology for weaponry. They say they're using it because for nuclear power. The North Koreans, on the other hand, have never really hidden the idea that eventually they do want to develop warheads. So on that level, it's a little bit different. The Iranians, I think, have an agenda where nuclear technology is a matter of national pride.
Mm-hmm.
They believe that the development of nuclear technology is what separates Iran from the rest of the Middle East.
I get it.
And they want to have the at some point, the flexibility maybe to turn out a weapon or two in the future.
And they've sort of made that clear over the weekend or that they are not going to stop developing, that they are once again going to restart their nuclear program.
Yeah, and this is what's going to happen now that, you know, the UN today is going to be hosting the nuclear non-proliferation treaty talks. And just yesterday there were 40,000 people on the streets here in New York arguing against and protesting nuclear power, protesting war, specifically protesting the war in Iraq.
And meanwhile, our administration, the President of the United States, I think, is sending an intern.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, 46 past the hour. We'll be back. We're going to talk about extreme renditioning to Uzbekistan. Also, a Marine lieutenant who is in a lot of trouble.
Yes.
And we want to get your opinion on that as well. 46 past the hour, Air America Radio.
From Monty Python, and you're listening to Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Morning Sedition. They're not the Messiah. They're very naughty boys on Air America Radio.
1-800-801-GAME. That's 1-800-801-GAME. Call now. 1-800-801-GAME.
One past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. Good morning, Akron and Cleveland, Ohio. We're broadcasting on WJMP, 1520 AM.
Yeah.
Air America for Akron and Cleveland.
Yeah.
We air Monday through Friday from 6 to 9 in the morning out there, Eastern Time. I will be in Ohio, in Cincinnati, this weekend at Go Bananas. There's going to be four shows. You're listening to 1530 WCKY, The Revolution of Talk Radio. Come check it out. You can go to the tour dates page of morningsedition.com for ticket info. You can also email morningsedition at sedition@airamericaradio.com. You know, I was reading some pieces over the weekend. This outsourcing of torture is a very interesting thing because, you know, it goes right in line with the idea of outsourcing. They cannot do it in this country because it's supposedly illegal.
Yeah.
But they can get it done better and cheaper with allies abroad if they just send terrorist suspects to... I think the original idea for what they call extreme renditioning was to send the suspects to their home country. But now it's just you can send it subcontract to any country that's willing to do the type of torture that you want. And apparently Uzbekistan was on the payroll for the Americans during the Afghanistan war, but it seems even a little before. And the reports of what comes out of there in terms of International Human Rights Watch is just horrendous.
Well, it's not just Human Rights Watch, Mark. Before September 11th, the American government talked about human rights violations in Uzbekistan. The State Department, 7 months before the terror attacks, issued a human rights report, and it was, according to this story, a litany of horrors. We're talking about people being beaten, often with blunt weapons, asphyxiation with gas masks, and the boiling of body parts.
Yeah.
That was before
awful.
September 11th. After September 11th, these same Uzbeks were our friends. $500 million was given over for border control and security measures. And Uzbekistan, according to the New York Times, has became a place where this renditioning was done on a pretty routine basis, at least in 2002 and 2003.
But doesn't it say also that it was going on a bit before September 11th as well? that it says that the turnabout in relations with Uzbekistan is particularly sharp before September 11th. There was a little before. Okay, it happened after. My mistake.
Yeah, no, it did. It happened after. Before the 11th, Uzbekistan was just another totalitarian regime.
Right.
After September 11th, because Uzbekistan shares a border with Afghanistan, it became a friend.
Yeah, they pumped like $500 million.
$500 million into border control and that sort of thing. And then they started renditioning prisoners caught by the Americans that they wanted to get information out of but couldn't torture here. They started renditioning them to a regime that they knew had tortured people. Their own State Department, our own State Department,
that was in the brochure. It's like, look, they boil people. Let's send them over there. They'll certainly get the truth out of them.
Yeah, and according to this report in the New York Times, from late 2001 until earlier this year, the CIA used two planes, a Gulfstream jet and a Boeing 737, to ferry terror suspects in U.S. custody to countries around the world, and those same planes ended up in Uzbekistan at least once that the New York Times has been able to verify. This was actually the day before my birthday in 2003, September 21st.
You could see the plane had the screaming guy on the tail.
Yeah. Now, there was also a rumor or a story at one point that a plane that was owned by the Boston Red Sox was used for similar kinds of renditioning.
That had the screaming guy with the bat.
With the bat in his hand. Yeah, now, you know, the question of this renditioning, we went through with Melissa Boyd Molly. The woman who was a former CIA agent who supported the rendition.
I think we got you. What did she say about it, Chris?
I think what has happened now, the CIA developed the rendition policy, sending people to third countries, at a time when it was very difficult to get indictments here in the U.S. because we didn't have very strong counterterrorism, anti-terrorism laws. We now have the Patriot Act. We should use that act. We should render these people, these terrorists, suspected terrorists, to the United States and put them through our court system and using all the checks and balances that we have in our system, which means not torturing these people.
But doesn't that break down in the sense that if you can't figure out what they're really accused of or they're not being held for anything, how do the court systems apply to these people other than to let them go?
Well, but you see, that's my point, is that you have to be able to follow a process. If you cannot find that they were involved in wrongdoing, then they shouldn't be in jail.
That was Melissa Boyle Molly. She was a former CIA agent, I believe. I know. And it was a very exciting interview we had with her before. But, you know, she is basically saying that you shouldn't torture people abroad. You shouldn't even rendition them abroad. They should be brought here, put through the legal system, and treated as if they were, what am I saying? Due process.
Yeah, they deserved some modicum of due process, which, of course, renditioning, by its very definition, denies them. They don't get any due process if they're on a Gulfstream on their way to Tashkent.
To say the least. So when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about, there's a case that's been ongoing. Second Lieutenant Ilario Pantano, he is a New Yorker, a native New Yorker who has been accused of,
murder,
shooting a couple of Iraqis in the back and then putting them on display as a warning to other Iraqis. And it's very shady as to, you know, what really happened. And we want to get your opinions on it. When we come back, we'll go into the story a little bit.
Yes, we shall. We got a bunch more for you in this next hour here on Air America Radio. Blah, blah, blah.
6 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's morning sedition on Air America Radio. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and, of course, lurking conservatives. The topic of the top of the hour for us right now is the story of Second Lieutenant Ilario Pantano. He is being accused of murder for the death of two Iraqis. And it's a very interesting story, Riley, because it's one of those stories that has, kind of an echo of Vietnam to it. It's a difficult story to parse because there are accusations. There is eyewitnesses that are questionable in their integrity. The military wants to make an example. Pantano's family and friends are rallying that he's being victimized and crucified. It's a very complex story.
It's a complex story, Mark, and it also is made more complex by the fact that the military, in most instances, likes to kind of divide things into good guy, bad guy.
Yeah.
And the question of whether Ilario Pantano is a good guy or a bad guy seems to be open to question. Now, there is no doubt that he shot these two people.
Right. This guy, his history is interesting. He was a Gulf War veteran.
Yes.
Comes back from the Gulf War. Grew up in New York in Hell's Kitchen. Not a great neighborhood. With financial assistance, went to the Horace Mann School, which is a very sort of upper scale
prep school
type of situation.
Yes.
And then he went to the Gulf War. He comes back. He goes to school. Took night classes at New York University, and then gets a job as an energy trader for Goldman Sachs. Makes some dough. Helps start a media company that focuses on interactive TV. And then when the September 11th, when the towers went down, he married a beautiful model. They got a kid on the way. The towers go down. He snaps into Marine mode, shaves his head, and reenlists.
Yes, and goes over to Iraq. Gets in a situation where he's dealing with these two individuals, had them covered with his M16. At a point, according to the testimony in this preliminary hearing, they started talking. Pantano shouted at them to stop. Then they supposedly turned in unison toward him. That's what his supporters say. The prosecution is saying that he shot them in the back, that he discharged something on the order of 60 rounds, something that his defense does not deny. But the prosecution, ironically enough, at least in this preliminary hearing, presented no evidence, no forensic evidence, to prove that the two were shot in the back. They were, however, as a matter of fact, unarmed.
Yeah, and they were, as a matter of fact, shot some 60 to 80 times each. I mean, there's a lot of bullets in these two guys.
Yeah.
And if they were unarmed, that's an odd bit of information there. Also, the motto of Lieutenant General James Mattis, who was at the time the commander of the 1st Marine Division of Iraq, which Ilario Pantano was part of, was, quote, "No better friend, no worse enemy." End quote. Now, apparently, after killing these two Iraqis, for whatever reason, it's unclear, Pantano made a sign that said, "No better friend, no worse enemy," with this quote, and placed it in the car where the bodies were, and decided it was probably better off that he not do that,
mm-hmm.
and he took the sign off. And this the reason for doing that, I mean, this just brings up so many ghosts of Vietnam, Riley. And it also, there's an interesting point to be made, is that, these guys are out there, they're in the field, they're making decisions on their own, they're taking things into their own hands, in some cases because they have to, in terms of arming, Humvees and trying to, get flak jackets, protect themselves because they were underarmed. But this is a command issue.
It's a command issue. And, Mark, it also, the defense here is saying the following, that if the first few shots that Pantano squeezed off were justified, then the other shots, in other words, if shots 1 through 5 were justified, shots 6 through 50 don't really matter. He was acting in self-defense and just, continued shooting. But there's also a larger thing here that goes back through Vietnam, even back to the end of the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the idea that you save lives by taking lives. That was the logic of dropping the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That, you were going to end up exacting a terrible toll, but in so doing, you would save more lives that would be lost if the fighting continued. And apparently, Pantano's logic was to send a message to people not to get involved in the insurgency, and by definition, the fewer insurgents there are, the fewer lives that are lost.
Right, but on an intimate level like this, probably goes back for as long as human beings have fought. It's just sticking the head on a stick.
Exactly.
It's Lord of the Flies. It's a story in Apocalypse Now about the inoculated arms, where the American soldiers came in and inoculated a village, and the VC came in and cut all those arms off and put them in a little pile as a warning to not be involved with the Americans. I mean, this is primitive stuff that's gone back, for as long as human beings have fought. Now, the fact of the matter is that we are, as American armed forces, or the American armed forces, are supposed to be above you know, acting on those primitive impulses. And
yes,
also on a command structure level, it's not supposed to happen.
It is not supposed to happen. But then, again, you know, when the military starts parsing good guys and bad guys, you have to kind of look at that with the added dimension of whether or not the Marine Corps or the armed forces in general are prepared to make an example out of one person to say, yes, look, the system works. This guy was accused of premeditated murder, and he was in fact convicted. Now, that hasn't happened yet. This is a preliminary hearing to determine whether or not there should be a general court-martial.
Right.
And Pantano, by the way, could face some very severe sanctions. He is accused of premeditated murder. That's murder in the first degree.
And, you know, it's interesting because this guy, General Mattis, the guy who was his superior, was the guy, if you remember, saying that it's fun to shoot some people.
Yeah.
So it's one of those really dicey areas of what is legal, what isn't legal in the frame of war. You know, what is, you know, how are they going to decipher this? Is he going to be made an example of? Is he guilty of something? Do we have enough evidence to see that? I don't know if people are keeping up this story, what you think of these situations. But if you have any opinion in relation to Second Lieutenant Ilario Pantano's fate, 1-866-303-2270 is our number. You know, and how does one go about prosecuting? Where do you draw a line? If we can, you know, I'd love to talk to some veterans about this because there's certainly ghosts of a lot of the stuff that went on in Vietnam that was considered criminal. It's very provocative to me, and we're going to try and follow the story as it unfolds. But if you have any input on this, 866-303-2270, we'd be curious to hear from you. So we'll be back in a few minutes. It's 13 past the hour.
Call us at 866.
Ha! That's awesome. Go on.
303.
Wow, yes. Yes, I love it.
2270.
Oh, yeah, drop the bomb. Drop it. There's not a dry eye in the house. Keep going.
That's 866-303-2270.
Okay, well, just so you know, it was good, but I was also being pretty generous.
This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
1-800-590-9870. That's 1-800-590-9870. 1-800-590-9870.
Past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. We're taking calls at 866-303-2270 in relation to the Ilario Pantano case. He may be up on manslaughter charges for killing two Iraqis in a fairly cloudy, vague situation that looks as, it could be a lot of things. But the fact that he put a sign on them and took a sign off of them saying, no better friend, no worse enemy is a little questionable.
Yeah.
My therapist asked me to keep track of my dreams, so here's my dream from last night. So I come home from work and I'm looking around for my wife Mishna, but no one's there. And I say, "Hey, baby, where are you?" Out of the kitchen come five women. I don't know how I know this, but I know I'm married to all of them. One of them is passive aggressive. One of them is a jealous type. One of them is a depressive. One of them is a secret drinker. I can smell her from across the room. One is a lesbian, and she is definitely cheating on me, which is a total turn on. Naturally, I ask them what they want me to do. The passive-aggressive one says, "Don't worry about me, Mark. It's whatever you want." And the jealous one says, "Where were you? And who are those other women?" The depressive says, "I'm going back to bed. You obviously hate me." And she disappears. The secret drinker just smiles and puts a lot of gum in her mouth. The lesbian says, "I'm going over to Brandy's for baby shower." Yeah, baby shower. I took some money. Don't wait up. God, she's hot. So it looks like I only have to deal with the passive-aggressive one and the jealous one. As long as I don't engage the drinker, I'll be fine. I decide to deal with the jealous one first. So I kiss the passive-aggressive one right in front of her, and she storms off to her mom's house. I turn to the passive-aggressive one after kissing her, and I say, "I'd like you to leave now." She says, "Fine, Mark. I want you to be happy." And she leaves. Outside the door, I hear her say, "Are you happy now, huh? Because I want you to be happy. God." The drinker's still propped up on the couch, so I cover her with an afghan. Just then, Mishna comes home, and I'm flooded with relief. I said, "Baby, there were all these creepy women, and it was awful." Mishna says, "Is the drunk one still here?" I point, and I say, "Yeah, but she's under the blanket." Mishna smiles and says, "Good." Then the dream got kind of dirty and personal. But at around 3, the drunk one got up and stumbled over to the diner for waffles. I woke up, and my bed was filled with corrugated tin. What could that mean? All right, let's start taking these calls and shift back into the topic at hand. Let's talk to Dave, listening to XM in Texas. Good morning, Dave.
No, I think that's Bob.
I'm sorry.
Cincinnati.
Wait, no, actually, I believe we're talking to Bob. Yes, Bob, how are you?
I'm all right.
Hey,
how
Bob.
How are you guys?
All right.
Good. What's your reaction to this? Are you a vet?
Yes, I am. Vietnam vet.
Uh-huh.
And I would like to call and say that war is an aberration, but unfortunately for humans, it's not. And when you're in a situation of combat and constant fear of your life, I saw it change everyone I knew, and
yeah.
mostly not for the good.
Sure.
And I saw incidents like similar to that many, many times. And unfortunately, I don't think you can blame the individual if they're in that situation totally. I mean, obviously, we're all responsible for what we do, but you can't blame a person for being changed when you're in that kind of situation and sometimes doing things that they certainly wouldn't have thought of doing on their own.
Now, Bob, does that mean that you think that the premeditated murder charges against Lieutenant Pantano are too much?
Yes, I do.
What would you have charged him with?
I think, you know, I don't know the facts of the case, so it's kind of hard for me to say exactly, but I think the manslaughter idea makes sense to me.
Okay.
All right, thanks for your call, then.
Thanks.
You're very welcome.
Okay, take care. You know, it's interesting because there's also another report here that we have about this guy, Delgado, Mr. Delgado. He was enlisted as a private in the Army Reserve.
Oh, that's Bob Herbert's column in the Times.
Yeah, and it's just interesting because he talks about being a translator, going into the armed forces and just seeing how these guys change in a war environment, how they, you know, they would be on the Humvees and some of them would, you know, hit these, you know, civilian Iraqis walking along the side of the street in the heads with Coke bottles and, you know, and kick them around and call them names. And these were civilians that they were supposed to be there helping. And a lot of them, because they don't want to be there, they don't feel like the country is necessarily behind this war. They feel like, you know, they're pissed off that they have to be in the situation, they take it out on the people of the country.
Yeah, they you know? Do end up taking it out on the people of the country. And, you know, quite frankly, I think that several wars, starting with Vietnam, raised the bar in terms of ethical conduct. I mean, there's certain conduct that was, by the way, used during the Second World War, during the First World War, maybe even as late as Korea, that is no longer tolerable on the part of Americans.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what our caller said before is very interesting as a veteran, is that he's not completely letting the idea off the hook,
mm-hmm.
but he says that, you know, war, there's no way it can't change you. To have that much cortisol pumping through your system, to be that intensely, you know, on watch all the time, to be that, you know, to have to, you know, mutate your fear into a type of defensiveness that is well articulated, certainly when you are a trained member of the military. And that there is a certain apology that operates on behalf of guys who have seen that says, look, you know, when you're under that kind of pressure, who the hell knows?
Well, yeah, but then the question is, was this guy in any way justified in shooting these two unarmed individuals?
Let's talk to Dave now in listening in Texas on XM. How are you, Dave?
Hi, Dave.
Pretty good, Mark.
Are you a vet, sir?
Yes, I went to this war.
Uh-huh.
And here's the thing, and the guys from Vietnam will understand this, is you're running through Baghdad with weapons out the window, and really what you are is you're a broadsword. You're not a scalpel, and the problem is that you don't know who your friends are and who your enemies are. And so everybody you're looking at is a target,
mm-hmm.
and you might have to shoot at them because they could whip weapons out of, you know, anywhere and start shooting at you. So what's going on is that all the soldiers have started to see that they are the broadsword and they are the main force there. And that, you know, ego is involved with that also. And I think the chain of command is losing their soldiers on that base level because they're losing control of their soldiers because the Abu Ghraib scandal relates to this, that, you know, the chain of command is always in control of their troops, and anybody who says that they're not, at least in this army, they, you know, they are, is they're in control of their soldiers, and nothing goes on without their knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm upset about is that you're not seeing more of the chain of command. What's going on with the chain of command? How are they being
held responsible?
You know, right, exactly. How come they're not being held responsible for these things also? Because yeah, I know that whenever I did anything wrong, even minor wrong, I had people up in my face crime about it.
Yeah, it's
so
good...
I don't know why the chain of command isn't being held responsible for these kinds of actions.
That's a good question, and certainly it's one we've asked here many times before. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thanks. And see, Dave has hit on exactly what we've talked to some military experts about, Mark, the whole notion that there's some kind of breakdown in the chain of command. We heard about it at Abu Ghraib. We heard about it in other situations over there where, it seems as though the people at the top, at least they claim publicly, to have been oblivious about what their, what the people they supervised were up to.
Yeah, quickly, Gary, listening on WINZ in Florida. What do you got to say, Gary?
Hey, Gary.
Good morning.
Yeah.
No, it sounds to me like he did exactly what George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld wanted him to do over there.
So that. But in the way that he did it, and in the way that he took charge of the situation, that is, I guess, morally questionable, and certainly with the disregard for the rules of engagement. Do you have any problem with that?
Well, I look at all the 100,000 dead ones, and I'm sure there was a lot of violations of rules of engagement with the rest of them,
mm-hmm.
in the upper command.
So you're saying that Bush and Rumsfeld should take the responsibility for this?
Sure.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Ultimately,
exactly.
That is where the blame does, in fact, rest, but they're going to put it on this guy, Pantano. My prediction is that they're going to end up at least putting him forward to a general court-martial, although, the witness against him, Coburn, didn't come out smelling like a rose in all this.
It's a gray area, and it's an interesting topic we'll probably return to. When we come back, Paul Krugman, the man who knows, is going to be telling us how this new Social Security plan is going to work.
Oh, you call that a plan?
I don't know. I don't even understand it.
Stay with us. We'll help you understand it when we come back on Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Good comes of that. And that's what is happening now. It is disgusting.
Jerry Springer on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo.
It's Air America's Morning Sedition program. Riley and I were talking earlier about, investing our own lack of responsibility when it comes to thinking about the future.
Yeah.
But the one thing we always thought we could have if we needed it, if we had to, is Social Security. But now that seems to be under attack. It seems to be being gutted, as Paul Krugman has been illustrating in his columns, for months now.
Yes.
And it's a privilege, as always, to have New York Times columnist and the author of The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. Paul Krugman is with us. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Hi, Paul.
Paul, I tell you, I read, I try to understand. I'm not an economist. I am, I guess I would assume, middle class. And according to you and many other people who seem to understand this, we're the ones who are going to lose out when this new Bush plan, if it goes, that is what's going to happen, right?
That's right. And how old are you?
I am 41 years old, Paul.
Yeah, well, you're in a position, I'm 10 years older, but... you're in a position to get really pretty badly hit by this.
Now,
how does
that work? I am trying to understand progressive indexing. I am trying to understand exactly what it means. If you could explain it to me as if I were a student, I would appreciate it.
Okay. The way Social Security works right now is that your initial benefit is based on your wage, the average wage you earned during your life, and then after that, it just is adjusted to keep up with inflation. That means that the average benefit, rises over time because wages do tend to, over the long run, although not under George Bush, wages tend to go up faster than price.
Mm-hmm.
It's ordinarily Social Security typically pays people a bit more than a third of their pre-retirement income.
Okay.
Now, what the original Bush idea was, we're going to actually stop the growth in Social Security payments. We're going to mark it down so that it even though wages will go up over the next 30, 40 years, Social Security benefits won't. So it's going to be just sort of frozen. And that's what they call price indexing. It's going to keep up with inflation, but it's not going to keep up with the growth of wages.
That seems unfair.
That seems very unfair. But it also, and it seems so unfair that they realized they could not sell that.
Mm-hmm.
So the latest version is something called progressive price indexing, which is a complicated formula. But what it does is, if you're very low income, if you're somebody earning less than $20,000 a year,
yeah,
then it'll work like it did under the old system, supposedly. If you're at the top end of the Social Security system, you know, Social Security ignores any income above about $90,000.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're right at the $90,000, it'll work exactly like I described. That your benefits will no longer go up with wages. So it freezes it. And if you're somewhere in between, the result is somewhere in between.
Mm-hmm.
So what it does is it says if you're somebody who's making $90,000 or more, Social Security is going to become increasingly irrelevant to people like you. By 30, 40 years down, it's going to be such a trivial benefit that you won't care about it. Supposedly, if you're poor, it'll remain like it always was.
Isn't that assuming that I invest, though? I mean,
that's what you get before you open the private account. Then if you open a private account, which is their, you know, which they will bully you into doing, basically, then what you're doing is basically taking out a mortgage on your benefits.
Right, so that is sort of bullying me into investing in their program, in their investment scheme.
And you get to put your payroll taxes into some investment scheme, into the hands of your friendly hedge fund, but you don't get the money for free. They dock your future benefits.
Wow.
So what will end up is basically if you actually implemented the scheme and it actually was carried out the way they describe it, most people would end up with basically no conventional Social Security benefits. You would not get a Social Security check. You would just have a private account. But the poor would still be getting Social Security benefits.
Paul, what implication do these changes have, or what implications do they have for the future of the program itself? You describe in your column today, a gut punch to the middle, the idea that they will eventually, at least from a public standpoint, make Social Security a poor people's program. What implications does that have?
Well, you know, what we know, I mean, think about if this thing went into effect then, you know, around 2045, 2050, middle-class people, the top 60% of the population, would be getting practically nothing. From their point of view, guy sort of in the middle would say, I've got my private account, it's not as big as I thought they told me it was going to be, but that's basically all I've got, and I don't really get any benefits. So it would look like a welfare program.
Okay.
And what we know is that whatever politicians may be saying now, welfare programs turn unpopular. They say, well, that's just for poor people. That's for them. They end up being cut. I mean, you can pass a law now that says we're not going to cut benefits for poor people. But that's not binding on whoever's running the country in 2045.
As is evidenced by Medicare.
Medicaid. Now,
yeah.
That's really important. Medicare, which is for everybody, is everybody over 65. Medicare is not only not being touched, but at least so far they've actually added a new benefit, mostly for the drug companies, but still they've added a new benefit. But Medicaid, which is the one that's to help out people in need, is being cut, and in Missouri they're actually going to eliminate it, so because it's a poor people's program. And look, I mean, my quote I wish I'd had for this morning's piece, but I just found it this morning, is Rick Santorum. Talking about cuts in low-income support, saying making people struggle a little bit, says Mr. Santorum, is not necessarily the worst thing. You can just see, once you start to say, oh, them, those poor people who are, particularly in the United States, are often, don't quite have the same shade of skin color as you and me, they tend to get cut. So this is actually a program to undermine the whole system.
Now, Paul, did President Bush's news conference last Thursday, during which time several of the questions obviously focused on Social Security, did he do himself any good with his answers, in your judgment?
Well, I'm always hesitant here. I don't think so. I mean, I think he might have had a slight bobble of hope for the privatizers because sounded a little bit better, at least, up until now, everybody's saying, oh, well, he hasn't presented a plan. And a certain number of people certain number of people in the punditocracy actually bought it. They said, oh, see, he's going to be Robin Hood. He's going to take from the rich and give to the poor, because that's kind of the way he described it. And they didn't actually, you know, sit down and take a look at what the plan actually is. So he may have given himself a brief, you know, like a one-day rally in the stock market. But I think it's actually not going to go anywhere.
So that was really, I mean, I got that sense, too, when I saw him pitch it, was that he was trying to look like the savior of the underclass.
That's right. And the thing to remember here is no increase. They're talking as if it's an increase in benefits for the poor. It's not. It's just a promise which is not credible to protect the poor. And it's an attempt to go after the middle class, which they're portraying as an attempt to go after the affluent, you know, or after the wealthy. And the thing to remember here is, by that definition, $30,000 a year is wealthy.
Well, it's horrifying, Paul, that, you know, what you're saying about Medicaid and also the recent bankruptcy legislation and now this with Social Security, it's really becoming an adapt-or-die culture. That, you know, what is going to be left for people that can't survive economically?
Well, that's the, you know, this is the vision. This is the, people like me have been trying to tell you that for some time, that the vision of the people now in power is that we all, you know, basically Franklin Roosevelt was a mistake, that the New Deal was a mistake, that society should be harsh and mean, that we should be living in the world of the 1920s, where if you were rich, boy, you were really rich, and if you were poor, well, you know, you might not make it, but hey, that's the way things are. And, you know, this is the way that they believe that makes a better society.
Mm. Paul, there's something that's been troubling me for a while, and that is that the indexing that people are talking about here is based on the premise that wages outgrow prices. We are now living in a period when the reverse is true. How much longer do you think that prices will actually outgrow wages? Are we just going through a small blip here?
I think we probably have it probably won't go on more than a couple more years. At some point, you do start to have you are going to start to have wages pulled up just because they're so low. But it is pretty amazing. I mean, if you really look, here's the way to put it: the share of after-tax profits in total income. So basically, the part of the thing that's going either, you know, that's going to the corporations is now at its highest level since we started keeping the statistics in 1929.
Wow!
So we are now. You never know. Maybe the world has totally changed and all historical norms are no longer relevant. Probably there are limits to how far this can go. But this is really this has been a recovery, so-called recovery, that has really just not touched working people at all.
Let me take a quick call, Paul. I got a caller with a question. Tommy listening in Rochester. How are you, Tommy? What's your question for
Paul?
Hey,
Tommy.
Hey, Mark and Mark. How are you guys doing?
All right.
Love the show.
Thanks.
I had a question for Mr. Krugman, which is, I keep wondering about this, and I haven't heard anybody ask the question. What exactly happens to the employer match?
Okay, thanks for your...
The new,
okay, thanks, Tommy. Okay.
Sure.
Paul?
Well, of course, you know, we still don't have... There still isn't a piece of paper laying out the plan. We still have... We're still guessing that it's the plan that this guy named Posen devised, so we don't actually have it, but... We're almost sure that the employer match would work exactly the same way as the payments in don't change at all. The employer match stays exactly the same.
The employer match is exactly what, Paul?
The employer match is, you know, when in principle your FICA is half paid by you, half paid by your employer.
I get it.
And it's actually just going to stay exactly the same.
Okay.
But you know, let me just say what the real question.
Okay.
Somebody asked is, what about disability?
Hmm.
Ah, Social Security disability.
Yeah, which is, you know, it's not just a retirement program. It's a very important disability program. And the plan that we think Bush is planning to adopt calls for pretty big cuts in disability benefits. And nobody asked that question on Thursday.
In your best case scenario, Paul, what would you say needs to be done to Social Security if you can sum it up in a minute or two?
I'd say at this point we probably shouldn't do anything. Because the forecasts that say it's going to be in trouble are really quite pessimistic, and people who do the numbers without making those pessimistic assumptions, are getting increasingly optimistic. You know, we had a, back in 1983, we had a fix that was supposed to keep the system good till 2060.
Yeah.
And more it's looking like that original fix might have been enough.
Mm. Well, thank you for joining us, Paul Krugman. I certainly enjoy talking to you, and I almost understand it now.
Okay.
Thanks, Paul.
Take care.
Take care.
Thank you.
It's 47 past the hour. We'll be back with Morning Remembrance, and I'm going to have to see if I understand this over the break. We'll talk to you in a second here on Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Our estate variation. Call American Life, 1-866-492-2500. That's 1-866-492-2500.
One past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Don't you just love Beck?
Yeah, is that who this is?
That's Beck.
This is the new one?
Yeah.
Man, that kind of rocks.
Yeah, that's. I think it's called Epro.
Is this the best song on the record?
One of the best.
Why do I still call it a record?
It's got a couple of really nice pieces of music on it.
It's a record. Is this the best song on
Kayla
the album?
Kayla and I like Black Tambourine, too.
That's
yeah?
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know why I haven't gotten it yet. Yeah, I do. I just haven't gotten it yet. I haven't gotten around to it. Why don't you make me? Oh, you can't
oh,
do that.
Oh, yeah.
I did that for you already, actually. I have the CD somewhere.
Oh, but you didn't give it to me.
I think I did. I thought I did.
I don't think you did.
I think you're a big liar.
Is this?
He gave him. He did give you something.
What is your problem? You know what I mean? It's like what? It's like here I'm having a regular Monday, and now you got to start this with me. You know?
Yeah,
what?
He does.
That's great. All right. Well, I'm glad you got all that time to sit around and make CDs for people. I'm glad everything's going well at home. That's good. That's good. Yeah. Why don't you think about maybe talking to your girlfriend? How would that be?
Hey, I had like sex like 5 times.
Oh, here we go.
You see how overboard that is? It's sort of like yeah. Now that I made the CD for Maron, I guess I can do what I didn't do all week. I understand. I understand. That's good.
My job's over.
All right.
Oh.
Unfortunately, it's that time of week again, folks. We have to turn that down, buddy. I know you like it. Apparently, I would like it too if you ever gave me the CD you made me. But you're too busy having
get
sex all
bid.
Weekend.
No.
Get to the bid. Yeah, okay. We're all done. Did you, win that one? Did you win that one? Chris, did you win that?
Let's toss a curve.
Who won? All right, fine now. Let's give me the silent treatment. What are you, a woman? All right. Anyways, unfortunately, it's that time of week again when we hear Morning Tradition take a moment at this time of sorrow, and I'm sorry that he had to deal with all this levity, to reflect in our morning remembrance.
As the people of a grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
Philip Morrison, A-bomb inventor. Philip Morrison, one of the main inventors of the atomic bomb, died last week after living much longer than his calculated half-life. In the 1940s, Morrison was a group leader of the Manhattan Project, which launched the age of nuclear weapons and even more insidious, the subsequent era of plastic pocket protectors. Protectors. Oh, my eyes are watering.
Yeah, it's bad.
Bad allergies. After the war, Morrison became a leader in the search for intelligent alien beings in the universe, and naturally a leader in the search for the most efficient ways to destroy them with radiation. My eyes are watering. There's a lot of ambient radiation in the studio.
A little bit. I heard that, yeah.
That does that to me.
Yeah, I know.
The deceased who witnessed the explosion of the first atomic bomb in New Mexico requested his irradiated body be donated to the United Way and used for the next 300 years as a nightlight in the local rest homes. Boys, you got some dandelions in here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Spring, Mark.
Yeah, I know.
A lot of allergies. It's spring.
Yeah.
J.B. Stoner, white supremacist. J.B. Stoner, the unrepentant white supremacist and anti-Semite implicated in at least 12 bombings of black churches during the Civil Rights era, died last week after his heart suddenly exploded under suspicious circumstances. daughter was a prime suspect in the 1958 bombing of the Baptist Church in Alabama. Wasn't indicted until 1977, which is understandable. I mean, you know, the paperwork's got to be a bitch, right? Things are really slow down there. A real go-getter, stoner at the age of 18, revived the dormant chapter of the KKK in Tennessee. A few years later, he headed the Stoner Christian Anti-Jewish Party. And a few years after that, he headed the Stop Making Drug Jokes About My Last Name and Pay Attention to What I'm Doing Anti-Catholic Society. Oh, I got something in my eye. When his trial finally took place, the jury found him guilty in 90 minutes. Or about one-fourth the time it took him to write the note he tossed through the church window reading, "Me make black church box go boom now." Not a smart man. That's what I'm saying. Oh, a lot of silence there.
Get on with it.
In 1974, the popular racist ran for lieutenant governor of Georgia, drawing nearly 10% of that state's crucial crazy sons of bitches vote. Stoner requested his body never apologize for anything, even if it's brought back to life in the future by black scientists in a Jewish hospital. Dan Pashman had an alternate punchline for that. I chose not to go for it, just for decorum's sake.
Quite a good idea.
Thank you. Well, this has been this week's Morning Remembrance. Until next time, this is Mort Mortensen saying, let's chop an onion.
Thanks, Mort. We're going to be back. We got Forzu Dar Gahi coming. He usually talks to us from Baghdad. He's actually in town. We're going to meet him for the first time.
Oh, yeah.
In person to tell us what's going on in Iraq.
And the iNews 5000 on.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and of course, lurking conservatives. Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily we have an iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator that I've been using for a few weeks now. So let's crank it up and feed it some headlines, shall we?
Yeah.
Here we go. From the Associated Press, school mistakes huge burrito for a weapon. Oh, boy. School mistakes huge burrito for a weapon. Where's this going, machine? Translation, school thwarts deadly Mexican gas attack. Oh, no. This machine is writing stinky jokes. Literally. All right, here we go. From the Chicago Sun-Times, First Lady stars at Laughs Aplenty D.C. Dinner. First Lady stars at Laughs Aplenty D.C. Dinner. Translation, Laura Bush does 10 minutes of material on Abu Ghraib. Kills. Oh, nothing. Hello. How's it going? Is this on? Hello. Hello. Wow. Just me and the machine in here. From the New York Times, Republican chairman exerts pressures on CBS. Republican chairman exerts pressure on PBS. Alleges bias. Okay, the translation of this one, let me read it again. Republican chairman exerts pressure on PBS, alleges bias. Translation, Barney sent to Guantanamo, guards ordered to break him. Oh, wow. Okay.
You mean to run anymore?
You want more? Maybe we can run you through the machine again.
Maybe we come up with different
with some funnier stuff. Where's my coffee? Come on. What's going on? Help me out, man. This is like, look at this. I know that everybody in the world is talking about this woman who ran away to avoid her wedding.
Yeah,
but, you know, what's interesting is that there's people are angry. They're mobilized. They're like, prosecute her. They are disappointed that she's not dead, that somebody didn't kidnap her and kill her. They are disappointed.
That her fiancé didn't kidnap her and kill her.
It's unbelievable. It's like, why don't they blame the damn media? Why don't they blame CNN for making a bigger deal out of this than is necessary and for creating this narrative to begin with? People are are such suckers.
Is that a liberal bias you're talking about?
Well, no, I'm saying that, you know, that they made the story. They put it out there into everybody's head that the possibility was the first place most people went was like, oh, she's dead. He killed her. You know, and people, for like they, because they're just, they react like that, and they immediately, because they're dumb sheep, are putting together all these stories in their heads, and then they're like, oh, it was just her? Well, they should prosecute her for disappointing us. Why isn't she dead? You know what? Her husband should kill her. Her fiancé should kill her because that's what we expected. That's what should happen. I'm so pissed off at that lady for doing that and taking advantage of our feelings. I think that she should be sentenced to being killed by her fiancé because that's what I expected.
Oh, Lord.
And so they should do it on television.
You're pro-death penalty, are you?
I just don't want to be disappointed by things that I assumed were true because I'm stupid and I just listen to the news. CNN is at fault. All of those news outlets are at fault for making a big deal out of this.
Well, look, CNN, remember, CNN is based in Atlanta, and this thing happened in the state of Georgia. You know, Atlanta, CNN sometimes tends to overblow stuff that happens in Georgia as a matter of course anyway.
Do you really believe that was just because it was local?
Huh? No, no. It was partly because it was easily within CNN's grasp, and of course it had all the elements. Look at the last time something like this happened.
Yeah.
Richard Jewell, 1996. What city?
Yeah.
Atlanta.
All right.
Where everybody had the guy tried and convicted of having done that bombing. And now it turns out that other guy, Rudolph, was the one that did it in the first place. But Richard Jewell might have been, I mean, he could have been lynched, that guy.
Do you think there were people at CNN going, oh, damn, she's alive? I thought we were going to ride this all the way through the trial. We had this thing at legs
year. That was Fox, too.
Yeah, oh, sure. Yeah. It's like, oh, she's alive and she did it herself. Well, we should try and make it her look like an idiot and for being stupid and lying and perhaps, yeah. We can
but
get
you know, the
people, to kill her.
The people in this suburban town where she comes from apparently are the ones, they're the ones that supposedly put out all this energy, were so worried, and they're the first ones lining up to say, oh, man, they need to do something to her.
Yeah,
they need to lock her up.
The fiancé should kill her. What if she freaked out?
Yeah, she freaked. And you know where she wound up? In your hometown.
In Albuquerque.
Albuquerque.
With a haircut, freaked out.
Yeah, but broke.
Yeah.
Ran out of money.
I really believe that, you know, in her heart, she thought that she there was no other way out. She left the ring. It wasn't like she took any money with her. She didn't bring her ID. She really thought in her weird manic freak out that she would just disappear. I'm just going to disappear.
Just write a note. Say, hey, I'm not feeling it. Goodbye.
Well, it's interesting what people will do out of fear of actually hurting somebody else or causing trouble.
Oh, causing trouble. So she didn't want to cause trouble for her fiancé, but her fiancé is the lead suspect when everybody thinks she's been killed.
Unbelievable.
You know?
He's probably, that's going to be some wedding. How'd you like to enter a marriage like this? Just like that,
hi, honey.
You wanna,
are you there?
Yeah.
You wanna, honey?
Yeah. When she showed back up, I'm sure there's this conversation. What the is wrong with you? What is wrong with you?
No, no. You know what? You know what they're gonna say in the public? I just thank God she's safe. Oh, I'm so happy she's safe. Oh, yes, of course I'm going through with the wedding.
Damn.
I'd have been out of there. There's no way in the world I would have married somebody who did that.
How much do you want to bet that this marriage ends in divorce?
Oh, no. You didn't know Ben. Johnny K Street.
That's right. You can put the odds on that, too. You think, I bet you that they don't even go through with it.
Oh, really?
I bet
they cancel the wedding?
I bet you they do. I mean, how are you going to have 600 guests that know that this went down? They're looking at this
person.
They're
all snickering in the background during the wedding.
What are you? Are you kidding? This didn't even happen at my wedding, and half of them were snickering. Like, how is in my first wedding, there was about 200 people going, my friends were saying, what the hell is he doing? What's he thinking? How's he gonna pull this off? Because I was like, no, I'm good, man. This is going to work out, man. Like, overnight, I'm going to change all my behavior and make this work.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that held for about 6 or 7 months. Unbelievable.
Well, 6 or 7 months is actually pretty good.
Well, I was with her for a long time.
Sure it is. If you can hold off on being who you are for 6 or 7 months, you're doing okay.
Riley, that's called lying to the person.
Yeah, well.
Some days I think I'm
we all lie when it comes to getting to the altar.
A little bit.
You know that love, honor, cherish, and obey stuff?
Yeah.
Nobody buys into that.
Oh, boy. This time, the second one, you got to kind of buy into it, though.
Well, yeah, except the obey part. Women are not buying the obey. They're not feeling obedience, I'll tell you.
Oh, no,
right.
I thought that was just for them, for us to obey them. I never ever assumed that my wife would ever obey me about anything.
I guess it is kind of the other way around.
You know what I have to, oh, my God, just to, oh, you know, it's the other way around. Really? It's unbelievable. And if it doesn't seem like it's working, she'll work around it so it does work.
Now, if you were going to marry this woman, I feel so bad we keep calling her this woman.
Yeah,
but if you're going to marry the runaway.
Jennifer.
If you're going to marry Jennifer, would you marry Jennifer now? If she came back and said, okay, well, I'm over it now,
FBI custody. She's like, I feel better. I'm sorry.
This was really a great catharsis for me. I'm ready now. Yeah. Come on, where's the hotel?
Well, there's a couple ways you can go. Like, first of all, it should show you this whole other side of your fiance. Like, she has this weird adventurous spirit, and she's willing to just sort of act on impulse and do crazy things. So on some level, that's like, wow, that can make for an exciting life. On the other level, it's sort of like, what are you, crazy? What do I need this kind of aggravation in my life for? And what else is she willing to do? Who the hell knows? Like, you could be married 6 months, and then, like, she I don't know. Why can't I think of something?
Look, I got a devious mind. I'll tell you. The only way I would marry this woman is to wait 6 or 7 months and then disappear myself.
Really?
Yeah.
And blame her?
No.
Yeah.
Not blame her. Just disappear.
I don't know.
Have a nice life.
I don't think
that's right.
Wait, so you're telling me that the husband should
marry
away
and split?
Marry and split. Hey, turnabout is fair play.
Yeah, that'd be funny. If he marries her and he splits and he's like, you remember me? My wife ran away. He called CNN. Yeah. I got a big story for you. I'm gone, man. Yeah. I am gone.
I'm on the road. I'm retracing her steps. I'm halfway to Albuquerque.
I think we just built a TV show for these two. Like, you know, every week one of them runs away and it's like, where is he?
reality TV.
I don't know. I don't think I would get married. I think there'd have to be a pretty big sit-down. I'd have to postpone the wedding and see what the hell she really felt. The last thing, I mean, she must really on some level just hate this guy.
I would think that there might be a bit of a problem here.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So did he beat her, you think?
No, I think she just freaked out.
Overbearing?
I almost freaked out. I mean, you think about that. You know, you're walking out on the altar. I just don't know how, you know, my big issue is not so much covering the story in terms of, like, what would happen and what's not going to happen. It's just that there are people out there that's like, she's still alive? Ah, jeez. Well, that's a disappointment. Put her in jail for misleading us.
But you know what? There is that little thing in the back of everybody. Well, maybe it's not in the back of everybody's head. But I think there's a little thing in the back of a lot of people's heads that say, you know, I'd like to do the same thing one day. I'd like to just wake up, leave all my stuff in the house, and go.
Yeah.
You know, just go.
Right. You have some things going on, man.
No, I don't. See, because I'm in control of all of this. But, I used to feel like that when I was in high school. Why don't I just, like, book go across the country? I have some relatives, one of my cousins one time, just went across country in a Greyhound bus just to go.
Yeah, but he's back, right? It was just a trip. He didn't disappear.
He didn't disappear.
Right. I used to think that all the time, too. It's like, I don't want to work anymore. I just want to go up into the country, get a little house in the middle of nowhere, you know, with some chickens.
I saw a documentary about a guy like that.
Yeah, but then, like, I picture it's like, all right, well, tell me about day three. What happens day three when I'm like, what the hell am I doing up here? You know, what am I doing?
This guy was a trapper. He loved it. He'd been up there for 40-something years.
Oh, so that was missing from my fantasy where I'd go out and kill animals.
Go out and kill animals, that's right, for money.
And I got pelts drying in the back.
That's right.
Yeah, Jeremiah Marin. Figure what that reference is.
He didn't teach himself how to dance, because that's what he was doing.
He's teaching himself how to dance?
He taught himself how to dance.
The dancing trapper?
I'm serious.
This is a friend of yours?
No, he's like an 80-year-old guy.
Oh, you saw it on TV?
I saw it on TV. I watch all kinds of weird stuff on TV, and I love that kind of thing.
And it took him like, three months to watch a documentary on HBO.
That's right.
Ask him about the dancing trapper. He'll give you the whole bio.
I'll give you the whole bio on the guy.
All right, we're going to come back and talk about Iraq with Borzu Daragahi, who's going to be here in studio. Stay with us, Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Rob Corddry from The Daily Show, here to remind you that when top news reporters and investigative journalists like me want their news skewed so far to the left it's wearing a dress, we turn to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
If you qualify to dramatically reduce your tax debt, call 800-661-0491 right now. That's 800-661-0491. Call right now.
If you pass the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Fair America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm heading for the hills. I'm going to get my traps and my snowshoes. I'm going out there, and I'm going to learn how to dance. Yeah, you inspired me, Riley.
Thank you.
I feel bad for saying that we have not met our next guest in person, because we have, but it was at a time where there was so much chaos here at Air America Radio. I had no idea who was in and out of the studio. That was back in May, but he's with us now. He's a Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist. We usually talk to him in Baghdad. He writes frequently for the New York Star Ledger, the Boston Globe, San Francisco Chronicle, Borzu Dargahi. Good morning.
Hi, Borzu.
Good to see you guys.
Good to see you.
Good to see you again. I'm going to say that now. I felt bad because I thought we hadn't met you, and now it's like I remember you.
Yeah.
But there was another person here that was on the show, and she's gone. And now I remember, because it's a very chaotic time, Borzu. But not as chaotic, obviously. What I'm Mr. Segway.
There you go.
There's a series of bombs. It looks like the death toll's up to 123 people in the last week since they put together this new cabinet. And they seem to be exploding everywhere as a reaction. This insurgency does not look like it's relenting. It doesn't look like it's gotten any better. It looks worse to me.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't seem like there's any let up in the violence. You know, the brass talk about, the U.S. brass talk about, you know, violence going down and so on. It's very interesting the numbers games people can play, because they pick a point where it was at the utmost peak, mm-hmm. and they say, see, it's down from then. But they don't, you know, they don't. I don't think that's a fair measure. I think the fair measure is March 2004, really before the insurgency exploded in Fallujah and Najaf. If you compare it to then, it's off the charts still.
Yeah, right. And it just seems to me that they're more organized, and there was an angle that they've been using, is that the reason you're seeing so much activity is because they're desperate, which is completely illogical.
Yeah, I mean, by that measure, if they overran the country and they had, you know, car bombings and explosions and attacks everywhere, then they would be completely desperate, completely about to lose.
Borzu, excuse me, how ready is this newly formed government to really try and engage the insurgency on its own terms and to win without the frontline participation of American forces?
You know, I've spoken to officials of the new clique that's in power now.
Clique, huh?
Well, it is sort of a clique. It is the sort of moderate Shia Islamist, but maybe a couple cliques, you know, because then you have the Kurds as well. And at least with regard to the moderate Islamists, Ibrahim Jafari's people, who's the prime minister, what he says is that we hope through good works, through you know, fixing the infrastructure, through reaching out, through showing that we're a regular government to stanch the insurgency, we don't think that we can defeat them militarily alone. So, I mean, I thought that was an interesting assessment. The problem is they haven't done anything. The problem is it's been 3 months and no reconstruction, no new jobs, no repairs, no seeable, no, you know, visible improvements in people's daily lives.
It sounds like this country.
Yeah, really. Now, you know, there is this issue of the Baathists and whether or not Baathists are going to be appointed to cabinet, ex-Baathists are going to be appointed to cabinet positions. Is that, in your judgment, crucial towards stopping or at least stemming the tide of violence?
I think it would have been a good idea. I think it would have, you know, it would have given a signal to people in the insurgency, people who were involved in the insurgency, that, like, look, there's another way. You know, but I think that didn't happen at all. I mean, it was quite the opposite. You know, I mean, there was a few people who were Sunni Arabs who were out and out rejected by the interim government because of their Baathist past.
Well, you know, in our administration, Rumsfeld thinks it's okay to use, you know, war criminals and, you know, whoever has the experience that will enable them to most effectively do the job. But I don't obviously necessarily agree with that. I mean, we can talk about it when we come back, but some of these guys are kind of bad guys, aren't they, some of the Baathists?
I think, yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of torturers and people with a lot of blood on their hands and so on. But, I mean, I think the U.S. needs to ask itself, is its objective creating this model democracy or bringing some measure of peace and stability? That's a question the American people need
to answer
for themselves.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that when we come back. A little more of Borzu Dargahi. Also, I want to talk a little bit about American troops' behavior in Iraq as well.
Absolutely. Stay with us. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Naughty Thomas Frank, the invariably foul-mouthed David Brock, and that incredible sicko, Tom Oliphant. This week on Franken.
Next year, HarperCollins will proudly publish The Diary of Ronald Reagan. Morning Sedition has obtained these exclusive entries from the pen of the nation's 40th president.
Last day as president. Well, I've increased the national debt more than any president in U.S. history. It's a good day to leave. God bless the sucker that takes over. Uh-oh, George is standing here.
This has been another excerpt from The Diary of Ronald Reagan, brought to you by Morning Sedition.
34 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America's Morning Sedition. We're talking to Borzu Daragahi. He's usually in Baghdad. We're happy he's here. He's been back. He's going to be in the States for a couple of weeks. Now, we've gotten some reports from a couple of conflicting reports. There's that Coburn piece, what, Patrick Coburn?
Patrick Coburn,
who
yes.
said that a lot of the out of Iraq is stilted because journalists are bunkered in. They're afraid to go out. A lot of American soldiers are not engaging in the most dangerous areas because they're too dangerous, and that some of the numbers that come out of Iraq are based on the fact that they're not engaging like they once did and that journalists are not covering as much as they once did. Is that true?
I mean, absolutely. I think that a lot of the journalists, I mean, there just aren't as many journalists as there were before, for one thing.
Out of fear or just because they want people to think that the war is done?
No, I think it's not a conspiracy. I think it's just it's impossible for certain people. If you're a 6'5", white, blonde-haired dude, you're going to have a hard time getting around Baghdad discreetly. I mean, for me, I'm lucky I'm of Middle East descent myself. Mm-hmm. And so I really blend in, you know, and I can get around. But for others, it's much more difficult.
Can I ask you a follow-up question to that? Is that I have noticed personally that the number of Iraqi national forces or Iraqi military being killed now is much higher than we've really seen with Americans. Is that because the Americans are detaching from the Iraqi battalions? Why is that all of a sudden these numbers so high?
There is that sense. I don't have any facts to back it up. I'd be cautious about saying it, but there is a sense on the streets that the U.S. forces are they're out less. They're out on patrol much less. They're hunkered down in their bases, and they're, trying to stay alive as much as they can, and they have the Iraqis out in front.
Is there resentment on behalf of the Iraqis on the street in terms of, like, you know, you got us into this mess, and now you have trained these guys who are not prepared to deal with this, and you leave them hanging?
I haven't picked up on that sense. I think that there is resentment that the U.S. forces are there, obviously, and a majority of the people would be happier if they weren't, but they don't know what would happen if they pulled out immediately.
Mm.
Borzu, you talked about the recently installed government as a clique. What would they have to do to transform themselves from a clique into an actual government?
I think they would have to probably reach out a little bit more to the people. And that's, you know, it's not all their fault. I mean, every time there's a Friday prayer ceremony, there's violence and there's the fear of violence. There's very difficult to have public forums, to have a public rally. The only political group that has had public rallies is the Communist Party in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
There's not been any attempt to reach out, and there's really been not for security reasons, and also I think Iraqi politics is, you know, it grew up under Saddam Hussein. It's not like what we think of as politics. It's most Iraqis think of politics as a dark, secretive operation. They don't think of it as a public forum for solving common problems.
How do tribal realities fit into this whole spectrum of politics? Because it seems to me that I always assumed that there's some talk now in the political landscape of Iraq that some territories will actually be under what could be called warlords of a certain tribal lords anyways.
I think that's happening to some extent, especially in Iraq's south,
mm-hmm.
you know, where if you I talked to a guy who's one of Iraq's IT professionals, and he was saying, for me to get any shipments in, I have to pay off these tribal leaders down in the south to get shipments of, you know, wireless routers or networking devices up. So I think there's a little bit of that already.
Hmm.
How does the insurgency manage to maintain what appears to be a pretty sophisticated technological infrastructure over there? I mean, they get their videos out, they get their material out. Apparently they got PDAs and all the rest of this technology just like we do here in the States.
I mean, a lot of these people are educated, you know, whether they're, you know, more Baathis, former Saddam Hussein regime loyalists, or whether they're Persian Gulf or Middle East jihadis and, you know, fueled by Islamist fervor. They're, you know, some of them are middle class people who have educations and, you know, really believe in this cause.
Mm-hmm. Is it coming from Syria? We keep hearing these stories about how, you know, the money and the weaponry and the technology are all funneled through Damascus.
I don't know about through Damascus, through the central government there, but I think definitely through the across the border there. You know, I mean, that is a very rough terrain. It's a rough terrain for a poor country like Syria to patrol. You know, I mean, you could get anything through any of those borders.
Let's do they have an interest in patrolling it? Do they have an interest in keeping that stuff out of Iraq?
I think that there is an interest on the part of a couple of the regimes in the region, especially Syria and Iran, to keep a certain level, to keep the pot boiling. You know, it's to their advantage.
You were saying before about, you know, it's really up to what the American administration, what their goal for Iraq is in terms of a governmental situation, that do they really want democracy or do they just want, you know, whatever falls into place most effectively to fall into place. What do you think it is that they want at this point in time?
The U.S. administration?
Yeah.
I think there's a little bit of confusion. I think that there's a lot of rhetoric about, you know, building a free, democratic Iraq. They sort of talk themselves into this, but I'm not, you know, I'm not certain if that's something that, you know, another country can do for another country. I'm not a political scientist, but it doesn't seem like that's something that, you know, that's been done historically.
Well, it seems that, like, you know, a lot of the money that was supposed to go into reconstruction has now been diverted into training Iraqi forces, and that is not necessarily panning out the way they want it. Is this thing, from the international community's perspective, or from your perspective as someone being over there, a failure?
I think it's too soon to say that. I think I would be hesitant to label it that.
Mm-hmm. Borzu, when we talk about the region, we have to talk about Iran. Because right up the street here at the United Nations in New York, Iran is going to be very much a topic of conversation as the world's nuclear powers come together to try and figure out who's going to have them and who's not. From where you sit, and given your instincts as a journalist, should the Iranian government be believed when they say publicly that they are procuring nuclear technology not for weapons but to build reactors, to build power plants? Is that a legitimate use for what they're trying to do here?
And I think it is a legitimate use. They're using a loophole in the NPT. I mean, look, I've spoken to, you know, let's attribute this to the European diplomats that I've spoken to in Tehran and France, where my wife lives and I visit a lot. And, I mean, their argument is clear. Is like, look, we know they're trying to get nuclear weapons. You know, it's obvious. It's, of course they are. And, especially when you have the world's only superpower threatening to overthrow your regime and you're already a paranoid, insulated government, well, what are you going to do? So we know that. What the Europeans are trying to do is, you know, sort of tie them up in a knot of regulations, inspections,
But they're not going for it, are they? They're not going to go for it.
Well, I think that the Iranians have taken the bait a little bit, especially with regard to the, you know, trade incentives that have been offered. You know, while the U.S. is cutting off all ties and continues to cut off all ties with Iran, you know, I mean, Renault, the French car manufacturer, is building a $1 billion worth of factories there. You know, Peugeot is expanding its investments there, these French companies. BMW just built a plant there. You know, Germany's Mercedes-Benz is investing there. And so this is kind of like, look, here's they're offering two paths.
Yeah.
So this other path, and we don't know what's going to happen, and you could be attacked. You go this path, trade, you know, expanded economic ties.
Well, that's interesting because, like, we're, you know, some Americans are led to believe that, you know, that an attack or that the Americans are going to invade there. It's imminent that they will be, you know, attacked. But it, apparently, according to the global business community, that's a long shot.
Oh, my. I was at the 10th annual petroleum fair
They have a petroleum fair?
The 10th annual petroleum exhibition. You will not believe the number of international firms, Germany, South Korea, Japan. I mean, cell phones were ringing. English was being spoken. Deals were being made. People from all over the world. It was unbelievable, and it was a little grotesque even, the amount of whining and dining and partying and people hanging out and making deals with the Iranians.
Felt like D.C., didn't
it? So then there's no real there's no real fear, because we've talked to people, I can't, it eludes me right now, who specifically, that says some people who aren't involved in the political party, just regular people in Iran, are sort of half preparing to be attacked. Is that not true?
In Iran.
Iran, yeah.
Yeah, I think that there's like preparations, but I think it's more spin than preparations. I think they're trying to, you know, send the message to the U.S. that, like, look, if you attack, here are the consequences. One, we can bomb and mine the Strait of Hormuz and, and stifle oil shipments. Two, we can create a lot of havoc in Iraq. You know, three, they can mess with, for one thing, I mean, one thing that is people call it a far-fetched theory. One thing they could do is recognize an independent Iraqi Kurdistan, you know, and give them access to oil, you know, that's one thing that, and then, and give them access to, I'm sorry, the ports of Iran. And that would really screw up U.S. plans in the region, because all the Iraqi Kurds need is one country to recognize it and give them access to ports and have trade relations with it, and that's that.
Wow. It's like there's all these different variables I can't even wrap my brain around. I guess I have one more question that's sort of out of context of what we were talking about now. But in terms of the suicide bombers that you see in Iraq, are these generally the guys who are doing that? Are they generally extreme jihadists? I mean, because I know that the insurgency is sort of multifaceted with Baathist jihadists, angry Iraqis. But who does the actual bombing?
I think it's mostly just lost people, you know, lost young people from the Middle East.
Because Mick told us, Mick Ware, we had on last week, said that, you know, that happens. Just literally some of these guys are just personally despondent or depressed or angry, and they just want to end their lives with a certain amount of, you know, fanfare.
I would absolutely agree with Mick, who's the dean of covering the insurgency. Mick Ware is a very, very a smart guy, and I would defer to his judgment on that, and I agree with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's been great talking to you.
And thanks, Lord.
Nice having you back again, and congratulations on the Pulitzer nomination. That's definitely something, huh?
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care, and we'll be back with, we have the liberal, we've got a
don't tell them, don't give it away.
A little fun coming back. 46 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition on the air. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
On the 90-day trial guarantee, call 1-877-289-9200. That's 1-877-289-9200.
That's it, 50 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Morning Tradition on Air America Radio. We're going to put this thing down here.
Hey, Mark.
What?
Hey, I'm sorry to bother you.
Yeah,
we have that angry liberal guy from the group NAMBLA.
No.
Or is it Balls Now?
I don't know.
Anyway, he's on line one.
I guess we got to talk to him. All right, hey, buddy, how's the revolution going?
Oh, okay, Mark. Well, now you're mocking me, and I don't appreciate it. And you know what? I'm thinking the revolution might not be for you, okay?
Oh, all right. I'm sorry. You're right. Go ahead and say it. I'll pretend I haven't heard it and that it's terribly exciting. Go ahead.
Okay. Get into the zone. Okay. Mark?
Yes?
Are you ready to join the revolution?
Whoa. Not really, no. I mean, wait. You supposedly have this group whose mission it is to hit the conservatives with the same dirty tactics they use on us, you know, lies, misinformation, and you know, you guys really haven't done anything yet. It's a lot of empty threats, and you don't follow through. I mean, you can't even put together a decent name for your group. First it was NAMBLA, and then what was it? It was Balls. Come on, man. Just write the acronym out and make sure it doesn't suck.
We are no longer called NAMBLA or Balls.
Okay.
We are now called the Progressive Underground Destabilization League.
Oh, okay. See, right there. Get a pen and write that acronym out. All right, do it. Are you doing it?
Okay. P-U-D... L.
And what's that spell? Poodle. Hi, I'm from the big scary liberal attack group, Poodle. It's not working for me, man.
The name is not important. Only the mission is important.
What mission? You're a joke, man. Have you done anything to attack the conservatives besides calling me and telling me you're going to attack the conservatives?
Oh, yes, Mark. Just this morning, I surfed the interweb and looked into the possibility of spamming and what is called the trolling of blogs. No one is safe from the vengeance of Poodle! Dude, you're right. We should rethink that name. That was the first time I said it out loud. Thanks for the tip on that one.
Come on, man. Spamming, trolling, none of that stuff got you out of your bedroom. Do you guys even have an office space? I mean, if someone were to send me to the Poodle headquarters, where would I go?
The nature of our organization, Mark, dictates we remain fluid at all times.
Oh, okay.
Do you see a headquarters as a target, and we have too many enemies. But if I can trust you...
Yeah, you can trust me. You called. You obviously trust me.
Okay. Today, and only today, I might be contacted during business hours at the Paramus Mall Lady Foot Locker. When you call, you'll probably get Stan unless he's with a customer. Then just wait a couple of minutes and call back. If Stan can't find me, I might be having a Jamba Juice or outside smoking or in the bathroom. I suffer from IBS. Then there's the possibility I might be downstairs at the record explosion courting Wanda, who also shares my keen interest in world music, particularly Afroprop from Senegal. You know what? Forget Stan. He's a lazy bastard. Instead, call information. Ask for the number of the Crabtree and Evelyn next door. Your contact there will be Lila. She's responsible, not like Stan. When I receive your message, I will call you back from a secure line, and then guess what happens?
What?
Revolution, that's what happens!
You keep telling us that.
Hey, asshole, I need the Gray Puma Cross Trainer 7.5. And today would be super.
What is that?
Mark, this line isn't secure. Maybe it would be better if we just kept it at me contacting you.
I'm supposed to be on break. Now, Tom. Now.
Okay, I heard you. Tom is my code name. It changes every 3 hours.
Okay, Tom. Well, why don't you call me back next week? Maybe your group will actually do something in the next 7 days.
Oh, you'll be hearing from Poodle. Right. My bad. Name change. You'll be hearing from the aforementioned group whose name will change that dwells in the bowels of the Paramus Mall Lady Foot Locker, crafting our plan for the decimation of the conservative propaganda machine. We will.
Please deposit 65 cents.
Dang it, Mark. I don't have...
Well, I hope he calls back.
Yeah,
he sounds like they're really doing the big work out there, and it's important that we have groups like that, you know, making progress. Right.
Next time, tell him use his cell phone or something. All right. Does he have a cell?
The revolution.
No, I guess not.
Oh my God.
That would just be another concession to corporate America.
It kills me. All right. I'm going to be in Cincinnati this weekend. That is May 5th. What is it? The 5th and 6th? It is, right?
Uh-oh.
Friday and Saturday. I'll be at Go Bananas. If you guys are listening, WCKY, 1530, the Revolution of Talk Radio. The Revolution of Talk Radio, WCKY. Come to Go Bananas. You can go to morningsedition.com and look at the tour date section for ticket infos. And, Riley, tomorrow we've got a pretty big show, my friend.
We got a pretty packed show. In fact, those of you who had a chance to watch 60 Minutes last night may have had a chance to see Eric Saar on there. And he's going to be with us tomorrow. He's going to share revelations about torture at Guantanamo Bay. His new book comes out today, and we'll have him tomorrow. Plus, and this is going to be a real treat, director and screenwriter John Sayles.
John Sayles?
John Sayles.
He's going to be hanging out? How cool is that going to be?
Mr. Lone Star.
That's great. Here's a liberal agenda for today from the Streisand Compound. One, argue that Lindy England's sentence should be reduced. She was just a woman struggling to make it in the male-dominated torture business. Pigs. Two, remind news organizations that the 30th anniversary of the fall of Saigon should be called the 30th anniversary of the birth of Ho Chi Minh City. Three, try to get continued use of the filibuster to be labeled the wind power option. Four, do a postmortem on your May Day celebrations. Another year without a popular uprising of the oppressed proletariat. What is it about a Marxist book fair that fails to ignite the passions of the working class? Five, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. Hope you're enjoying that runaway bride story. Why don't you just skip right on by that one about the North Korean nukes? I'm sure nothing will come of that. Wake up, sheeple. Your brain is running away. So that's going to be great. John Sayles tomorrow.
And we're not done.
Okay.
We got a simulcast with a British radio show because they got an election coming up, you know.
Well, that's right. We can throw some Blair questions.
There you go. Blair, Iraq, and much, much more for you tomorrow. Great show today, Marion.
You too, Riley.
This is Air America Radio.